Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. As we have all experienced, change is hard. Whether it is bad habits, depression, anxiety, motivation, poor self-care, or any other condition we wish to change, long-standing patterns of thoughts and behaviors often seem an insurmountable mountain to climb. All too often, we find ourselves repeating the same efforts over and over again, expecting a different result. Finding ourselves back at the same place, we are discouraged and frustrated, still looking for the elusive key that will unlock our ability to alter these troubling feelings, thoughts, and behaviors. On today's program, we are joined by a leading expert in the study and practice of how people change. It's his belief that we all possess within us the ability to alter the course of our lives by practicing new ways of thinking and behaving. Bill O'Hanlon is a licensed marriage and family therapist who has authored or co-authored 35 books, most of which focus on strategies for change. His best-selling book, Do One Thing Different, has been featured on The Oprah Winfrey Show, The Today Show, and a variety of other television and radio programs. Bill is also a prolific speaker, having given over 3,500 presentations throughout the world. He is certified by the National Board of Certified Clinical Hypnotherapists and is a fellow and board member of the American Psychotherapy Association. Welcome to the show, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Prentice. Thanks for having me.
All right, I want to encourage listeners to take this opportunity to call in or email if you have questions about today's topic. As always, you can reach us in one of three ways. You can call our local number at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us on our toll-free number. That's 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is to email your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. All right, Bill. Before we get going, I kind of had this idea for a series of talks from the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, which you presented at back in December, which was really good. So I'm kind of collecting you folks, the best minds, I think, in the field. And I'm super excited to have you talk a little bit today about your model of solution-oriented practice. Can you talk a little bit about how you came up with that through your own life and your experiences?
Well, yeah, I know you've been talking to other people who were at the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference, and people said that's like the Woodstock of psychotherapy, where you get all these great super groups of some of the most well-known therapists. And how psychotherapists become well-known, typically they write books and they travel around and teach stuff. And I was an unlikely candidate to do that because I was a very shy and kind of disorganized hippie guy back in the 70s, early 70s. And I came across this very eccentric psychiatrist named Milton Erickson, who lived in the Phoenix area. I went to school at Arizona State, which was right in that area in Tempe. And I came across him. He came to the art gallery where I was a work-study student. And there was an article about him in Newsweek magazine that week. And I read it, and I was hooked. And I wormed my way into working for him. I didn't have any money, so I became his gardener while I was in graduate school studying to be a psychotherapist. And he told me a story one day that absolutely, like being hit by a billiard ball, it just changed the course of my life. It's a long story, so I won't go into all the details. But basically, he was asked to see this woman who was had gotten depressed. And he went to her house, and he was traveling and teaching and speaking, as I did for years. And he was in Milwaukee, and it was the aunt of a former patient of Dr. Erickson's. And this patient of Dr. Erickson said, "My aunt, I talk to her every week. She's become really depressed. She's had an illness. She's been in a wheelchair." And this is in the 1950s. She can't get around the world because the world wasn't wheelchair accessible. So Erickson agreed to see her and see if he could help her out while he was in town. And he just had an hour or two after his lecture. He went to her house. She had been told that he was coming, and he rang the doorbell, and Dr. Erickson had had polio when he was younger. So here they were in the 50s. Dr. Erickson walked with canes, and this woman was in a wheelchair, so they instantly had a bond. They were kind of different from the mainstream. And this woman showed him around her house. She'd inherited a big house and a lot of money from her family, like 11 rooms. And she gave him a tour of the house, and it was a big house, but it seemed depressing to him because she kept the curtains all drawn. She put ramps in the whole house so she could get around. But she said she used to be really active in her community and in her church, and she'd been staying home the last couple of years. She was a little embarrassed about being in the wheelchair, as well as it was hard to get around the world. So she gave Erickson this whole tour, and at the end of the tour, she showed him what she'd saved for last, her pride and joy, which was the greenhouse that was attached to her house. Erickson saw that she'd been working on some plants, and he grew up on a farm, so he was interested in that. And she'd gotten some cuttings off this main plant, which was an African violet plant, and made about 15 or 20 other little African violet plants. And he said he recommended that she go and take those plants around to people. He said, you've been really depressed and you've been pretty isolated, and I recommend, because you're a really religious person, you get your church bulletin and church membership list, start taking those African violets around to people in your religious, church, in your church that have had happy or sad events in their lives, graduations and birthdays and births and deaths and illnesses and marriages and engagements and, happy and sad events in the congregation's life, and bring your human and spiritual presence to their lives. And so she agreed. Maybe she'd been kind of wrapped up in her own problems for the last few years and neglected her religious and community duties. So she did that, and about 11 years later, she died. And when I was studying with Dr. Erickson, he showed me the article that was written about her when she died. It was from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel from 1967 or something like that. And the headline was, African Violet Queen Dies Mourned by Thousands. And the upshot is they couldn't fit the people into the church that wanted to go to a memorial service because she touched so many people in her community and had spent the last 11 years of her life not depressed. And I was stunned by this story after Dr. Erickson told me, and we went out to the garden where I was helping him with gardening because I couldn't afford to pay him. I said, Dr. Erickson, I'm in graduate school, and I'm studying about how to treat depression, and it's nothing about what you talked about. It was, it's all about medications and finding where their history of depression, their family history of depression, their, irrational thinking or unhelpful thinking that leads them to be depressed, and how do I work in this African violet way that she did with this woman? And he looked the ground for a little while, and he wasn't big on answering questions. He was sort of like a Zen master, and he'd just tell stories and be kind of enigmatic. And he said, I looked around her life. Everything looked depressing except those African violets. That was the only sign of life I could see. And I thought it'd be easier to focus on the African violet parts of her life than to weed out the depression. And then I went to work in the garden. And that, for me, was a pivotal moment. I thought, okay, what I'm going to do in my therapy practice when I'm trying to help people who are suffering and need to change is figure out how to grow the African violet parts of their lives. That is, find out what's working in their lives and grow that. And in order to do that, sometimes you have to get them out of the old ruts, as you were saying, and the old definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So right. I spent the rest of my career, that was in 1977 when he told me that story when I was working for him, and I've spent the rest of my career trying to both understand that and communicate it to other people, and that led to me becoming a speaker, travel all around the world. As you mentioned, I've done over 3,500 talks around the world, and I went on to write 35 books, and I wasn't much of a writer when I started either. So it certainly energized me to get excited about this way of spreading this way of thinking and approaching issues in life.
I love that story about the African Violet Queen. And one of the things that the more I read, I read Change 101 and Do One Thing Different as in preparation for this interview. And Erickson seems like all the people who studied with him, he seems to just look at people's lives. And like you mentioned, and come up with these sort of, I don't want to say simple, but what can you do to enhance what's positive? And one of the things he mentioned to the lady in your story is, like, the first thing he did was open the curtains. Seems simple, but
bring some light in. Yeah, it was like she was hiding from the world, and also it's kind of depressing being around a dark, drab, you know, kind of dreary house. And so, you know, he opens those curtains, and then they go out into the sunlight, into the greenhouse where there's a lot of light. And, yeah, I think he would do small things sometimes. And that, you know, I was studying, as most people who become therapists, all these grand theories of what was wrong with people. And then I realized, in all my studies, nobody was talking about what was right with people. And obviously people are a mixture, especially when they've come to psychotherapy for some help. They're suffering in some way, so there are troubled parts of their lives, their past, their presence. But there are also really good parts of people's life. People are stronger and more resilient than sometimes we give them credit for. They have more resources than we give them credit for, and that was the thing. And that change seems daunting, but if you can make it in small, you know, like that old movie of Bill Murray's, baby steps, baby steps. If you can take some baby steps sometimes in the direction of change. Dr. Erickson once told me, he had quite a sense of humor. He said, if you fall on your face, at least you're heading in the right direction, which I kind of like. You know, you're at least moving forward. Even if you fail at your attempts to change, some movement in the right direction can be encouraging and give you some hope, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I often tell my clients, keep stumbling forward. You know, if you're falling, keep stumbling forward.
Yeah, or if you fall down, pick something up and learn something from that and see if you can apply it somewhere in the future.
Yeah, what can you find on the ground?
So
psychology and psychiatry, you point out and do one thing different and change 101 that they are not really necessarily geared toward change, like positive psychology or solution-focused or solution-oriented. But many of these theories, can you talk about the focus more on explanations and why people can't change?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned the evolution of psychotherapy. The first one I went to was way back in 1985, and again, it was some of the giants in our field, the Carl Rogers and, you know, Jay Haley and all these really well-known names.
Virginia Satir.
Virginia Satir was there in that one, too. And there were a whole bunch of people, some people from the more analytic point of view, some people from the more family therapy or interactional point of view. But what I noticed is that most of them, I would say most, but not all, were focused on explanations. That is, much of their thinking and much of their activity when they did psychotherapy was focused on figuring out where the problem came from and what caused it. And there are endless theories about that. There's economic theories, there's, you know, biochemical theories, genetic theories, neurological theories, there's
attachment.
There's emotional theories, there's cognitive theories. You just talked to Dr. Burns, who's a great proponent of you know, thinking as being the fulcrum for change. And there's economic and gender theories and sexual orientation theories. There, you probably talked to a bunch of experts who have a bunch of those orientations. What I finally figured out was, being at that evolution of psychotherapy, everyone has a plausible explanation for why people have problems, and they all disagree with one another. If you get them on a panel, they're like, no, it's cognitive. No, it's behavioral. No, it's economic. No, it's sociopolitical. No, it's genetic. No, it's biochemical. And you can make a case for any of those things, but in the end, having a good explanation is sort of like the booby prize. What helps you change? If that explanation leads to change, that's great. But what I started to divide the world of change theories and psychotherapy theories is into explanatory theories, which give you a really good explanation for why people are having problems, and change-oriented theories, which give you some interventions. And Dr. Erickson was much more on the side of change. And because I'd been depressed when I was younger, when I started to become a psychotherapist, I was really attracted to the ones that were much more go directly towards change. You don't need to go through the explanatory theory to create change. And so I became a great proponent of, there's nothing wrong with explanations as long as they lead to change. And sometimes in my studies, some of the explanations led to non-change. That is, this person can't change because they're too genetically or biochemically damaged,
right,
too damaged by early trauma, and that stuff drove me wacky. to use a very clinical term. That is, I really was bothered if you came up with an explanation that said people can't change because they're too messed up by what happened in the past. And so I never wanted one of those explanations. I only wanted explanations that would help me help people relieve suffering and change. And I believe that pretty much everyone can change. I'm sort of psychotically optimistic about the possibilities for people. And I think it's a bit wrong-headed to spend most of our time figuring out a clever or really elegant explanation for why people are having problems. I think we should spend more time in figuring out how to help them relieve suffering and change.
All right, if you're just tuning in, my guest is author, speaker, and therapist Bill O'Hanlon. We are discussing various ways people can affect positive change in their lives and focusing particularly on a solution-oriented approach. If you have a specific question for Bill or a comment about today's topic, you can reach us in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. I think right now we'll go ahead to the phones. We have Caroline. You're on line one with Bill O'Hanlon.
Yes, hi. I'm sure I'm not the first to think of this, but years ago I realized that the only constant in life is change. We can be changing to the positive or burrowing down more into the negative, but I think we need to look realistically in how we got this way. There has been such an acceleration of change in the family structure. And the damage to one family, to the parents gets visited on the children, et cetera, et cetera. There has to be some kind of intercession. And when there were smaller groups of people in villages and whatever, there was more opportunity for that to happen. Of course, now with the millions of people that we have living in different bound areas, it's not happening. And I think I mentioned this to you before. I remember hearing that the Plains Indians referred to the whites coming across as the people who beat their children. So these things are really crucial, and I don't see us looking at ways to improve the family. And it's not a matter of victimizing those that are having problems, as seems to happen. First of all, it makes us feel better because we didn't have parents that did that, or if we did, we got over it. So it won't happen to us because we aren't doing and haven't had done to us what these other people have. So, you know, that's one way to make us feel better. But I think there's an element of guilt in humans when they do not reach out to help. I do believe there's something that is bred in there at the beginning. And so anyway, that's it. And it's a matter of our total survival is how we treat each other and how we step in. That young man that shot up the elementary school, he lived in the basement with all windows covered. Now, that would seem to me an insane thing for parents to do, but for whatever reason, they let him do it, and of course, he spent most of his time on the computer, and God knows what else is there.
All right, Caroline, thanks so much
for
the call.
Thanks, Caroline, and I would say, I would just say, I know we're probably going to go to a break in a minute, but I'm going to answer this in a weird way. So I think, you know, Caroline makes a really good point. I think we have an invitation to disconnection in our current culture, and maybe, you know, as she said, back when the Plains Indian, they maybe saw a little of that happening even 150 years ago. So what I would say, and now it's happening in Native American cultures and Native cultures in Alaska. So, you know, I think we have spread that disconnective kind of habit. But what I'm really interested in, I'm going to answer this in a weird way. When I was first a therapist, I would often work with people who had cocaine problems, and it was really hard to change. You know, alcohol problems, cocaine problems, drug problems. And I would work sometimes with women who were being battered in relationships, were being hurt. And those were really hard problems in psychotherapy. And I came across two books that gave me a great deal of hope. And they weren't books by psychotherapists. They were books by sociologists who studied One was about people who'd naturally, without any drug treatment program, stop using cocaine. They found people in the inner city Baltimore who'd stopped using cocaine on their own.
Spontaneous remission?
Not spontaneous, because they did things, but non-treatment change.
Right.
And they just studied, and they asked those people, how did you do it? And this whole book was about how people got off drugs without anybody else's, I mean, you know, any formal treatment change, because they used relatives and friends sometimes. That was part of it, just what Carolyn was saying. They used connections, positive connections to help. The other one was a book called The Few Who Got Out, and it was about women who'd successfully escaped from abusive relationships without getting killed or stalked or anything like that. They'd actually made it out, the few who made it out. And it was about these women and how they did it. And I thought, you know what I want to study? We can, again, you can say, oh, it's all breaking down and people are disconnected. And that's certainly, you can make a case for that, and I agree. There are bad problems and maybe worse problems. Either more depression, more violence. And I'm really interested in who are those people who are raised in the same kind of culture that's disconnective, but somehow do, as Carolyn said, reach out and help other people, connect with other people, despite the fact they were raised in either neglectful or abusive situations or disconnected situations. Those are the people that fascinate me, so we can use those as role models for helping the people that aren't, that don't overcome it naturally. So I'm really fascinated by that, and I think Carolyn brought up a good point.
All right, yeah, thanks for the call, Carolyn. You know, that connection piece, it reminds me of a fairly famous study with rats and heroin, and they're in isolation, they will use 100% of the time until they die. And when they have a rat park with rats, other rats to have sex with, and toys and rat wheels, there is virtually no mortality.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, from that. So connection.
Yeah. Connection, big thing, definitely.
It's a big one, and you talk a lot about connection in your books and the importance of reaching out and doing things, because depression
and getting over trauma and things like that. There's a lot to connection and connection with spirituality. We can talk about that later if we get a chance. Yeah.
So let's talk briefly about the importance of motivation in change. What can people do? Why is it so important? And how do people find motivation, negative, positive? Can you talk a little bit about your theories on motivation and how to enhance it?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you talked about this book, Change 101. And this was a book, this was the only book I did not come up with an idea for myself. My book company, I had a colleague that wanted to write a book with me. I've co-written a few books. And he proposed this book, and we wrote up a proposal for it and sent it into Norton, which was my main publisher, and W.W. Norton. And they came back and said, you know, this book is too similar to your co-author's, Bill's, to your co-author's other book. We don't want to publish it. But if you wanted to write a book about how change happens, we would love that. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I didn't have any idea to write a book like that. I usually write my books about very specific things, like how to get out of depression, how to overcome trauma,
right,
things like that. And occasionally, you know, big ones like do one thing different, which is a more general book about how to change. And so I said, no, but thank you anyway. And I tell you, 3 months later, I woke up in the middle of the night and the outline for that book came. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is how different motivation is. Again, not one theory of motivation, but some people are motivated by something in the future. I tend to be. I tend to look forward to where I would like to be. But then I've had many clients that have no sense of where they want to be in the future. All they know is where they don't want to be. So I call that positive or negative motivation. Positive motivation being where you want something and you're longing for something and that pulls you towards it. Negative motivation is something you don't want in your life and it pushes you away from it. And I think also there's time orientation with this. Some people are oriented to the past. I never want to be like my parents,
right,
or I don't want to go back to that worst time in my life where I was really alcoholic and having big troubles and I didn't have any money and da 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 da. They're focused on the past and what they don't want, Or they're focused on the past and say, you know, I'd just like to get back to where I was when life was simpler, I was happier. And so they're past-oriented in their motivation. Or some people are present-oriented, some people are future-oriented. So I learned with my clients to really, in psychotherapy, to really pay attention to what moves them, what gets them, what propels them, what repels them. It's both things, what repels them and what propels them, and not to assume they have the same kind of motivations that I do, because mine is more future-oriented and positive. Some people is more past-oriented negative, present-oriented negative, present-oriented positive. So I just want to pay attention to that, but I'll answer more generically. I think everyone is motivated. Even the people that look like they're not motivated, I've always been able to find something that they're motivated for, you know. And so I don't believe there's anybody who's unmotivated that's still alive on the planet.
Yeah, and sometimes it's just the motivation to avoid pain, like you said.
Like, absolutely, yeah.
I do not want to keep feeling this way, or I don't
want
to go back.
They don't know what they want, but they know what they don't want, exactly.
All right, so you're really talking about meeting people where they are and using their strengths, and maybe their strength is a negative motivation.
Absolutely. It could be a negative thing. And even though it's negative, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, even though we call it negative.
Why is change so hard? I mean, I have people in my office all the time. They want to change, and I've experienced in my own life, like, obviously I don't want to keep doing this thing anymore, but I keep doing it over and over. Why is it so difficult?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I wrote this book, Do One Thing Different, which got me on Oprah and was the best-selling book of the 35 I've written. And we've learned a lot since then. That was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And we're thinking about doing a 20th anniversary revision. And in that 20 years, one of the things we've learned is there is an amazing thing about the human brain. Humans can change at any time in life. There are very few animals. Once an animal learns their kind of behavioral patterns and their context, they don't typically change. I mean, I think humans and cockroaches are the most adaptable beings on the planet. Cockroaches seem to be everywhere, and they seem to survive pretty well. But human beings can live in the Saharan Desert. They can live in Antarctica. We're amazingly adaptable, because we can change our brains and our neurology and our physiology a little, mostly our brains and our neurology. Because when we're born, we can't survive alone. Like a horse, you know, a little pony comes out, and within a couple of hours, it's surviving on its own. Human beings can't survive on their own until, you know, years.
We're incredibly vulnerable, yeah.
Very vulnerable. That's the bad news, because we're vulnerable if nobody's there to take care of us or help us. The good news is our brains are developing that whole time. We develop what they now know as brain plasticity. When I was in undergraduate school and learning about neurological psychology, I was told that the brain stops developing in late teenage, early adult years. After that, it's fixed. You don't get any new brain cells, and you don't make any new patterns, basically. Hard to learn a language when you're an adult, kind of thing.
Right.
And so what we've discovered is that's not so. It's a little harder, but anybody can learn anything at any time in life, as long as they don't have major, you know, brain damage. And so that's the good news, but it's also the bad news, and that gets around to the answer to your question. What happens with human beings is, because we're really efficient, is we get brain grooved. That is, when you're driving to work, if you drive to work every day or even take the train or a bus, you tend to fall into the same pattern, and you can drive basically on autopilot. You don't think about it anymore after you've done it a couple of times. And so human beings, when they do something once or twice or 15 times or 30 times, get grooved. And the brain is so efficient and neurology is so efficient, it tends to keep us in that groove. You know, I heard the comedian Steve Martin one time give a comedy routine, and he said, I was just in France, he said, those French, they have a different word for everything. And, you know, it was a funny little joke, but we tend to, you know, when we go to France as American tourists and we don't have any French, we tend to just try to communicate with French people by speaking louder. I'm said, where is the train station? They still don't understand it because we don't know the words for train station, you know, and God, whatever it is. And so we tend to just do the same thing over and over again and expect different results because we're grooved. Now, you can jump out of that groove, but it's hard to do it, and that's why, maybe when we come back from the break, we'll talk about it's easier to make small changes than big and dramatic changes.
Yep, that's where we will pick up in the second half. We're right at the halfway point, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. My guest today is author, speaker, and therapist Bill O'Hanlon. We're discussing the various ways people can affect positive change in their lives using a solution-oriented approach. If you have a specific question for Bill or a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call us. Our local phone number is 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Bill O'Hanlon. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into the program, my guest is author, speaker, and therapist Bill O'Hanlon. We're talking about the various ways people can affect change in their lives using a solution-oriented approach. If you have a specific question for Bill or a comment about today's topic, please give us a call. Our local phone number is 550-8433. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you missed the first part of today's conversation, you can catch the rebroadcast of Line 1 tonight at 8, or you can listen to it on our podcast and find it along with all of our other past programs in our library of archive shows. You just go to the alaskapublic.org homepage and click on the radio tab and then scroll down to Line One. Please remember, if you're listening to this program on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording and we will not be able to accept phone calls. All right, Bill, let's get right into in the book, Do One Thing Different. And let's talk about that idea. You sort of led into it right before the break.
Right.
Small changes.
Small changes. Well, first, I just want to say thank you for having me on the program. And I've been up to, I live in New Mexico at this point, but I've been up to Alaska many times. And my sister used to live there for many years, and she owned a something of a long-time residence. You may remember it was called the Bread Factory. It was in downtown Anchorage. So some long-time listeners or long-time Anchorage residents may remember it was an organic food restaurant back in the day, back in the 70s. So I just want to say hello to everyone who I might have seen there. I was up there a few times. I played some music up there in my sister's restaurant. Change, easier than big change. Because of what I was talking about right before the break, and that is that the human brain and human neurology tends to get grooved. That is, it's easier to do the thing we've learned and done a bunch of times because our neurology, our physiology, our brains get very efficient once we do it. You know, I play guitar, and I can play guitar while I was talking to you like this. My fingers have learned to play it. That's the good news. The bad news is it's a little hard when you're grooved to make a change. So I wrote this whole book, Do One Thing Different, about making one small change to make a bigger change. And you can do various experiments where you make the change, but three areas that I like to focus on is make this, if you're having problems, make the smallest change you can find in one of three areas. One is change what I call the doing. That's actions or interactions, how you relate to other people and how you interact with other people, and how you speak about things. Again, I think you talked with Dr. David Burns about changing your thinking, and partly changing your thinking is changing how you speak.
Changing the automatic negative thoughts, yeah.
Absolutely, or any thoughts. I don't even care if they're negative. It just get out of the groove. And so for me, I'll give you an example, because for a while in the 1980s, there was a kind of an epidemic, or we first discovered, at least as therapists, of eating disorders. You know, anorexia was named for a long time. But in the 70s, there started to be a new disorder that was called bulimorexia at first and then bulimia. Now, most people know that. It's binging and purging, mm-hmm. either, you know, eating and vomiting, or eating and taking laxatives, or, you know, binging and starving yourself. There are variations on it. But I had a bunch of people that came in, and I started to specialize in it. And two things that I can think of. One is that fit in this kind of intervention. One is I would have people come in, usually women, and they would say, oh, I was really bad this week. And what they meant by that is they overate, or they ate in a way that they were ashamed about, or that, you know, got them into trouble. And or I was really good this week. And I would say, you know, can you just indulge me? I'm a therapist. And I think part of your problem may be that you're evaluating yourself on your behavior, how, whether you're good or bad, or you're evaluating yourself on how much you weigh or how you think you look. And so instead of saying I was good this week or bad this week, those are kind of evaluative terms, can you just say I ate the way I thought I should this week, or I didn't eat the way I thought I should, I ate the way I thought I shouldn't this week, rather than that blanket statement about you're good or bad. And they would come into the next session, they'd say, I was really bad, I mean, I didn't eat the way I thought I should eat.
Right.
They would change their language, and they would tell me after a couple of weeks, you know, that really changed me. I stopped judging myself so harshly, because they changed the languaging of it. They changed how they spoke about it. Now, I thought of another client who was just compulsively eating. When she'd get around a certain food, she would overeat, typically with that food. And I said, well, let's try an experiment. Are you right-handed? Yes, I'm right-handed. Okay, every time you're around that food, I just want you to eat everything with holding the utensils with your left hand. And she did, and she started laughing in the middle of the meal. She could barely get stuff to her mouth, number one, because it was so awkward. It wasn't in her usual pattern. It wasn't in the usual groove. So if I just told her, look, stop binging, it's not good for you, she knew that already, and she told herself that. It wasn't helping. But making a small change that was under her control, like eating with her left hand instead of her right hand, got her out of the groove. So then she had some moments of choice. So what we're trying to do is kind of break up the old patterns so you can develop new ones. And so the simplest way to do that is change the doing. And I said that's change actions, interactions, and language, how you speak about it, and or change the viewing, what you're paying attention to or how you're making sense of it. Now, when you were talking to Dr. Burns the last few weeks, his focus in change is changing how people are thinking about things. He's really focused on the cognitive and the unhelpful beliefs and ideas and the negative thoughts and all that kind of stuff. That's changing the viewing. That's part of changing the viewing. But the part of changing the viewing is what you're paying attention to. So sometimes I would tell parents, I know your kid's been acting up, and over the next week, I want to find out what he's been doing or she's been doing well. So I want you to catch your kid doing something right at least once a day, every day for the next week. And they come in, they go, it's a different kid.
Yeah.
What did you do? My kid is different. They weren't noticing the good things the kid was doing. They were only noticing the bad things, so they were upset about him, and it makes sense. But if you can change the viewing, that's the second way to make small changes. And that's a pretty small change. Just pay it once a day. Just notice something your kid is doing right, even if it's neutral. They're just sitting there. They're not doing anything. You go, wow, they're not misbehaving. They're just sitting there quietly, you know. Oh, cool. And so it's changing the doing, changing viewing, and the last one is change the context. Like, I would have couples sometimes when they were arguing, go out for a walk. Go out to sit in the front seat of the car and have your argument. One couple, this wasn't my intervention, but a client of mine who came up with it himself or herself, it was a couple that came up with it. They, when they were arguing, you've read about this in the Do One Thing Different book, they decided they were arguing and really getting in bad arguments and saying really terrible things that were wounding to one another. And they decided when they start to argue and get out of control with their arguments, he would take off all his clothes, lie down in the bathtub, she would sit on the toilet fully clothed next to him, and they would continue their argument. And of course they couldn't. They would crack up laughing. It was so absurd. So just changing the context, what happens around the problem, and, you know, whatever that may be, going to a different location, you know, if you're religious, reading the Bible right before your problem, whatever it may be that really changes the context. So it's change the doing, change the viewing, change the context, and try a bunch of experiments to change the smallest thing that's under your control to find out whether that gives you leverage for bigger change. And keep making experiments until you get out of the groove, until you get out of the problem groove.
Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, you mentioned somebody. I mean, we get into these patterns. You saw grooves, but I just call it this automatic behavior that we don't even notice. And one of the things you talked about was somebody who ate potato chips mindlessly while they're watching TV, and then you had them do the same thing, eat with their left hand, and just brought their attention to that activity and shifted their brain into noticing what they were doing, and it wasn't the same.
Yeah, that's good. Or put Tabasco sauce on each potato chip before you eat it. I mean, anything to really wake you up. I think that's part of it, is to get you out of that trance of the same thing over and over again. So,
all right, we're going to go to the phones real quick. Is it Rihanna? You're on line one with Bill O'Hanlon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've been listening for not quite the whole show, but I happen to be one of the survivors of a very abusive childhood, adolescence, and early adulthood. And the patterns, now that I've learned our brain grooves, I understand where that behavior came from. My mom grew up and she had a similar situation. But you had mentioned the lady that had judged herself, good or bad, during my therapy and overcoming, I got to that very subject, and it was the core of it is we weren't safe with abusive people who were our parents. And so we had to make sure the environment or what we were doing that we got abused with was perfect. The house was clean. You did your chores, you got good grades, you went to work, you weren't chewing chips in the living room the wrong way, and you didn't get hurt. And so every time your brain got used to, am I being good or bad? And you never learned how to judge differently. Now I see that, and I learned don't judge myself, but put myself in the moment, and that really helped me heal. I still have to make new brain grooves, and that it takes practice. But,
I was great. I love that.
To learn, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I had a client who was really perfectionistic, similar background to what you were talking about, and I just gave her a kind of a playful assignment. She had to do everything perfectly, so I said, go out and deliberately every day make a mistake. And the first day she went out, and she went into a coffee shop, and, you know, she bought some coffee, and the person said, it'll be $4.36. And this was back in the days when people still use cash. She gave him $4.02. He said, no, $4.36. And then she gave him $4.38. And he said, no, $4.36, and he gave her 2 pennies back, and she gave one of the pennies back, and she just deliberately made that mistake so she'd kind of get out of that old perfectionistic thing, like, I'm stupid if I make a mistake, I'm bad, I'm going to get hurt if I make a mistake. And each day she'd do something silly that wasn't that consequential, and nothing terrible would happen, and she found it nerve-wracking to do it at first and embarrassing to do it. But after about a week, she started to have a lot of fun. And it's like, I don't have to be perfect. I'm not going to be hurt. Nothing terrible is going to happen if I make a simple mistake. And so it sounds like you've done a little of that on your own, and that's really cool.
I've had to. I am putting together a presentation helping women overcome domestic violence, rape, poverty, abandonment, divorce, depression, and I personally overcome all of those. I wouldn't say it's religion, but it is a belief and acceptance in Jesus Christ into my heart and believing in the Son, the Father, and the Holy Spirit that's actually helped me today to even be alive. It saved my life, even in the moment of being in the presence of a man that could take my life at any moment.
All right, Rhiannon, thanks so much for the call. I really do appreciate it. Those are good points, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Yes, I would be interested in talking with you further about this.
Cool.
I'm actually putting together a book. So, no, thank you for your work and in what you're doing with this.
Thanks, Rhiannon. All right, let's keep motoring through here, Bill. We talked about doing things differently. Do you want to talk about patterns, mentors? Like, what's the you talked a little bit about patterns.
One of the things, because sometimes, you know, people say, well, one of the things that Dr. Erickson taught me is that people have resources within themselves. And somebody wrote a book about Dr. Erickson's work, The Answer Within. He thought people had the answers within. I don't think that's always the case. I think it's interesting in that I've sometimes had to find my answers outside of myself. And, you know, one of the things is I grew up in a household that was kind of, what I want to say, always kind of messy. There were a bunch of magazines and papers and books around, and there were eight kids, so it was kind of hard to keep it all clean. But my parents were both a little messy. And as I grew up, I did the same pattern. I would just have everything messy. My natural tendency was to have things messy. And I started to model on people who weren't messy. I would throw my clothes on the floor, and then I had a friend who always looked great. And I said to him, you know, you always look really well put together. And I stayed at his house one time in a distant city, and we came in after the day, and I took off my work clothes. I was speaking, and I threw him on the chair. He said, well, there you go. He said, you know, what I do when I come home is I take out my clothes, I hang them up so they stay nice. You know, they stay both not wrinkled but also nice. They don't get trampled on or, you know, messed up. And I was like, oh, I never do that. And so I started to find role models and mentors who had patterns that I didn't have and that I didn't have when I was growing up. I mean, you know, Rhiannon just called. She's probably seen other people who lived in different families who didn't have the same pattern her family did. And she found some within herself. She probably didn't go out and abuse other people as maybe she was abused in her family. So she overcame that, even though she didn't have great, you know, role models at home. She overcame some of it, but you can even overcome more by looking outside yourself for people who have already done something you would really like to do or already being a way that you would really like to be, and just role model them from a distance or follow them around or get them to mentor you, get them to role model for you and watch how they do life, listen to how they do life, listen to how they think about things if you can talk to them or read a book by, you know, sometimes reading a book, you can get their thinking patterns that are different from your thinking patterns. I think that's the great news about books. I mean, I communicated with you, Prentice, before I knew you because you read some of my books.
Right.
And, you know, that's my trying to communicate a different way of being and thinking and acting and environment than the one you grew up in, which was had a certain set of influences, and the one I grew up in. I've changed some of mine over the years, too. So I think finding role models is one of the ways we can change, and either distant role models or people we actually know that we can follow around or observe.
And you mentioned negative role models, like I'm not going to be like my father or I'm not going to be like that person.
Right, exactly. And so you can find both of those kind of models. And we talked earlier, there's nothing, you know, some people try it with all this positive psychology and sort of the positive mindset of Americans. We're into positivity. And I'd say, yeah, but you can mine negativity for helpful stuff as well. You know, I think learning what you don't want to be and how you don't want to think and how you don't want to act and how you don't want to feel is just as important as figuring out how you do and reacting against the things that you don't prefer.
Well, especially if you don't know, if you don't have the positive role models from early childhood or from your life, sometimes you start with what you don't want and then you work towards developing that.
Well, and I'm always really impressed with people who grow up in terrible circumstances and somehow don't follow in the footsteps of those terrible circumstances, people who transcend abusive backgrounds or neglectful backgrounds or impoverished backgrounds where they didn't learn great money things, and they figure it out as they go along, and they fear, I don't want to be like that. I never want to be as poor or struggling as my parents were, so or my family was, and they've somehow changed it. Now, sometimes you go right down the groove of your family, and sometimes you go against it. So, yeah, I think it's you can. Yeah, that's the good thing about human beings is we have some flexibility and choice. We don't have to be determined by our past, our genetics. You know, we're influenced by all that stuff, but we don't have to be determined by it.
Yeah, one of my my favorite quotes is, a man may be a fool and not know it, but not if he is married. That was out of your book. And how do you use the the relationships, your intimate relationships, to help facilitate that change rather than create conflict?
You know, there's this old myth among a lot of therapists, you can't change for anybody else, and nobody else can change you. I just don't think that's right. I think I have changed by being in relationships. I've changed by falling in love with somebody who was different than I was, and our patterns didn't mesh very well. And I think being in a great relationship with a strong and cool person who has their own set of problems but is really generally a good person is like being in 24/7 residential, you know, 365 days residential psychoanalysis. That is, it'll push you up against any of those issues you have. They'll come to the foreground in your relationships. And if you're kind about it and they're kind about it, they'll call you to a better you. And so I think, you know, as long as it's not mean-spirited, like, you know, people, you probably know this, but there's some researchers that have researched, you know, some bad patterns in relationships where you judge people and you put them down and you wall them out and you freeze them out, and that's disdain and disgust. As long as you don't have disdain and disgust, but you let people know, hey, what you're doing is not working for me. It's not nice. You know, I had a partner who used to say, Bill, you're better than that. And I was like, oh, shoot, she's right. I am better than that. I hate to hear that because I'm sort of in my worst element and my most defensive and not nice place. And she'd call me to my better self. And I think relationships can be, again, like residential psychotherapy, if you're committed, if you're willing to stay through the tough stuff and talk it out and not be mean and not, you know, wall people out or be disdainful or judgmental. And they're not disdainful or judgmental. They're just kindly, lovingly confronting you on something you're doing that's not working. And that's how a lot of people stop drug and alcohol behaviors, is that other people say, this doesn't work anymore. It's just not working for me. I've been pursuing a songwriting career. One of my favorite recent songwriters, this guy named Jason Isbell, and he just got to the bottom of his barrel and he fell in love with a woman who just didn't like his excessive drinking and the behavior he did, and he changed. He didn't, you know, he was going along just fine, messing his life up, but then he fell in love with someone and it mattered to him. So I think relationships can be our worst nightmares or they can be our greatest healings. And when we go into a relationship and we're committed to it, we can find great healing there if we're willing to stick with it and be respectful to one another and call each other to the best of ourselves.
I think you make a really good point, though. It takes two people who have an open mind about their own flaws and who are willing to look at themselves and through their partner's eyes and not treat each other with, you know, the four horsemen. I mean, two of them, contempt and defensiveness. to just crush relationships, but it is a perpetual opportunity for growth.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I know you grew up in a family of therapists who are, you know, it's like if you have people, it doesn't mean therapists are all great, but
right.
You have people that have some insight into their own behavior and don't blame everything on others. It's a cool environment to grow up in. It's a sort of a growing environment. It's a really supportive and also confrontive environment to grow up in that you can't get away with your usual junk that you pull, you know, and irresponsibility and blaming others. And it's kind of nice if you have people that are self-aware and that are kind in their motivations. So I think, you know, I wrote a book called Love is a Verb years ago, and it's about really taking actions to support love. But I also think love is a noun. You got to find the right people to be around that you're willing to commit to and that are worth your committing to, and they find you worthy of their commitment and they're hanging in there with your weird and unhelpful things you sometimes do and the defensive ways that you sometimes react. And I love, you know, being in relationships has been as impactful for me as being in therapy. I've really learned a lot from being in relationships, family relationships and love relationships, you know, romantic love relationships.
All right, we only have a few minutes left, but I want, can you talk, I just love this chapter, the 11 strategies for staying stuck. Can you kind of...
Well, we already covered some of them. You know, it's like, it's like blame other people for your problems and don't look at yourself. That's a good one. That's a really good one. The other one is I can't change, you know, have that impossibility mindset. And I tried to kind of make a dent in that when I talked about the legacy of human beings having plasticity, behavioral plasticity, neuroplasticity, they call it brain plasticity, neurological plasticity. So, you know, I think people can read the whole book if they want the 11 strategies, but it was by tongue in cheek saying, you know, here, if you want to stay stuck, here are great strategies for staying stuck. You can bring up any others you want, but I just think it's sort of a fun way to say, okay, don't do these things, you know, like what's wrong with this picture? Don't do these things because we already know how not to change. You know, keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. The old definition of insanity. Think the same way. Focus on the same things. Be in the same environment. Be around the same people. I mean, one of the great things about your radio show, this show you're doing, is you're exposing yourself to a bunch of new ideas every week. And, you know, some people don't ever read a book, or they read a book a year. And you're exposing yourself to different idea after different idea after different idea every week. And, you know, it's like you're in an intense learning laboratory. That's the opposite of how not to change. The opposite of how not to change is just hang around people who agree with you. Don't ever challenge your own ideas. And so I would say we all envy you in terms of your position that you've created for yourself, that you've exposed yourself to all these cool ideas you're getting every week, and then you find your own way within those. And I bet you find yourself changing some things in the weeks in between these conversations.
It has been a remarkable education, and I'm enjoying it so much as talking to you folks. All right, I guess that's it, Bill. I really do appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thanks for the contribution you're making to everyone who listens through Alaska Public Radio.
All right. Take care. I want to take just a minute to promote a showing of Screenagers that will take place at West High Auditorium on April 9th from 7 to 9. I'll be hosting that, so come on out. That's open to the public. There's an abundance of evidence that humans are not the most rational decision makers when it comes to health. Next week, Dr. Woodard hosts a conversation with Dr. Sarah Gorman, the author of Denying to the Grave. So tune in and be sure to listen to that. Eric Bork was the web editor for today's program, and Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us today. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.